content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. We'll begin today with an article titled, Stop Trying to Make the Humanities Relevant. And this was written by Thomas Chatterton Williams. For humanities departments to continue to matter, they must challenge the modern world rather than accommodate it. Humanities departments seem to be in perpetual crisis. Fewer students are enrolling in them. The Trump administration is cutting their funding. Smartphones and social media are hastening the collapse of reading and attention spans, even among students at elite schools. Americans are becoming more skeptical about the economic value of any four-year degree, let alone one in comparative literature. In answer to these and other challenges, many colleges are trying to make the humanities, quote, relevant, end quote. Some are accommodating reduced attention spans by assigning excerpts rather than books. Others are responding to financial anxieties by restructuring departments to emphasize their practicality if they aren't eliminating programs altogether. But such adaptations and compromises only exacerbate perhaps the most insidious threat the humanities face, and one that's not often discussed. As a humanities professor myself, the biggest danger I see to the discipline is the growing perception, fueled by the ubiquity of large language models, that knowledge is cheap, a resource whose procurement ought to be easy and frictionless. The humanities, which value rigorous inquiry for its own sake, will always be at odds with a world that thinks this way. That's why relevance is a futile goal. For humanities departments to continue to matter, they must challenge the modern world rather than accommodate it. Indeed, the most useful lesson the humanities have to offer today is a profoundly countercultural one. Difficulty is good and an end in its own right. For the past several years, I've had the pleasantly vague title Visiting Professor of Humanities at Bard College, a small liberal arts school in New York's Hudson Valley. Bard has given me a remit as simple as it is generous, to teach books and ideas I think are important. Every November, I submit course descriptions for two spring semesters. This year, one on Albert Camus and his influences, the other exploring the idea of the American dream through black writers such as Frederick Douglass and James Baldwin. Within a few years of the courses being posted, prospective students start writing me to say how eager they are to immerse themselves in the texts. I've learned to relish their zeal because I know it won't last. When they start my class, many of my bright, self-selecting students appear to be unacquainted with the difficulty of close reading. By the end of the semester, only a fraction seem to have gotten through the texts and writing assignments without outsourcing at least some of their work to AI. In my course on Camus, most students will be able to remember the philosopher's famous injunction to imagine Sisyphus happy, but few will demonstrate mastery of the abstruse train of thought that led him to it. Not many are fully willing to try. I began teaching in early 2023, 2 months after OpenAI released ChatGPT. It could generate some amusing parlor tricks. A personal favorite was interweaving Shakespearean sonnets with mid-90s rap. But it wasn't good at much else. During my first semester, one or two students turned in writing that featured AI's distinctive blend of fluency and superficiality, which was easy to detect. Chatbots look very different today. As the technology has become more sophisticated, more of my students have tried to pass off AI-generated writing as their own. The craftier ones will use chatbots to come up with phrases or insights that they shape into their own prose. The work this yields is usually competent, making AI's influence difficult to spot, but not exceptional. If I have suspicions about a student's take-home essay, maybe it looks nothing like their in-class writing assignments, I run it through AI detectors. These are far from perfect, of course, but when they indicate the use of AI, I confront the student, and he or she almost always confesses. Still, in just 3 years, ChatGPT and its competitors have rendered take-home essays, what I consider the central exercise of humanistic learning, nearly useless to assign and almost impossible to assess. More recently, I've come to suspect that, in addition to using large language models to ghostwrite papers, some of my students are relying on them to prepare for in-class discussion. At any rate, their contributions are getting blander and more interchangeable, less daring. Eccentric or original observations are becoming rarer. If I'm right that AI is furnishing my students with talking points, then it has almost entirely eliminated the possibility that they arrive at some transformative insight on their own, which is what makes wrestling with words and ideas so joyful and fruitful in the first place. Probing a text can be enjoyable, but also tiring, even borderline painful. That's good. Exhausting our mental faculties, such as through deep reading or effortful writing, is what makes them more potent. Physical exercise works the same way. AI, by contrast, promises knowledge without effort, just as many people see in GLP-1 drugs the possibility of weight loss without willpower. Although both have legitimate uses, their widespread adoption has diminished our capacity to appreciate, let alone endure, the sustained and challenging work required to flourish beyond the level of simple appearance. Only through difficulty do we improve our powers of thought and perception, which we carry with us in every endeavor. This is the true source of the humanities' relevance. Camus' great realization was that, in a meaningless world, we create our own meaning and quality through willed struggle, a lesson that AI threatens to obscure, but the humanities are uniquely poised to teach. Sisyphus is assigned to roll his rock for eternity, Camus writes, yet he can still be happy so long as, each time he comes to the bottom of the hill, he's the one who chooses to turn around and rise back up. In addition to being the visiting professor, Thomas Chatterton Williams is a staff writer at The Atlantic and a non-resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Our second story, The Real Reason for the Hong Kong Fire. This was written by Timothy McLaughlin. The world's deadliest residential fire in more than four decades was still burning up a block of Hong Kong apartment buildings when pundits settled on a culprit, bamboo. Surely the bamboo scaffolding that had surrounded the Wang Fuk Court towers explained how the flames tore through the complex so quickly. There can be only one outcome, the Independent declared. The bamboo has to go. But the disaster, which killed at least 160 people, reflects problems much more profound than the choice of scaffolding. These problems first took root as China prepared to assume control of Hong Kong from Britain in 1997. Concerned that the transition would scare off foreign investors, Chinese leaders tried to woo real estate tycoons and other business elites by giving them key roles overseeing the city's future governance. Beijing was then propped up this new ruling class as a bulwark against efforts to further democratize the territory. The nexus between Hong Kong's government and big business gave rise to a real estate market that served a select few elites rather than most residents. Limited supply and soaring costs precipitated a decades-long housing crisis, consigning roughly 220,000 Hong Kongers to subdivided apartments, sometimes called, quote, coffin homes, end quote, which can be smaller than a parking space. Meanwhile, the market delivered increasing returns to the city's elite. Of the 16 Hong Kongers listed in the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, 7 owe their family fortune to real estate. As the housing market generated greater wealth for Hong Kong's tycoons, the construction and real estate industries achieved growing immunity from regulatory oversight. Government deference, in turn, allowed corruption and corner-cutting to proliferate, particularly among contractors involved in renovating the city's limited housing stock. This dynamic most likely played a key role in last month's fire. As part of a government investigation, Hong Kong authorities allege that the construction company that had been renovating the Wang Fuk Court Towers for the past year used unsafe materials. The government's concern centered not on the much-aligned bamboo, but on flammable window cladding made of polystyrene foam, as well as exterior netting that wasn't fire retardant. The investigation also revealed evidence that contractors might have deactivated some fire alarms during the renovation work and given false information to officials. Neither the construction company, which has a history of safety violations, nor a consultancy involved in the renovation process, has publicly commented on the investigation. But the city's authorities, too, bear responsibility. They seem to have disregarded warning signs about the multi-million-dollar renovation. Jason Poon Chok Hung, a construction executive turned industry watchdog, told me that a small group of residents emailed city officials twice in September to say they were worried about the safety netting covering the towers posed a fire, that the safety netting posed a fire hazard. Officials ignored their concerns, Poon said. Then in mid-October, a large fire erupted in the city's business district, burning for hours and injuring four people. Poon described this as a warning from the gods about the conflagration to come. Just over a month later, a few minutes before 3 p.m. on November 26th, flames started rising from up Block F of Wang Fuk Court. Soon they spread from building to building, engulfing most of the complex. As part of a criminal investigation into the fire, police have arrested some 20 people, including construction firm bosses and fire equipment contractors. John Lee, Hong Kong's chief executive, has initiated a judge-led review of the tower's renovation process. At the same time, however, authorities have stifled public expressions of discontent and suppressed civic-led solutions, arresting three people for alleged sedition. One of the three is reportedly a university student who circulated a petition calling for the government to ensure housing is provided for displaced residents and to determine the role that regulatory neglect may have played in the fire, among other demands. An online version of the document garnered more than 10,000 signatures. Then it vanished. That wasn't the only evidence that dissent had been silenced. On one university campus, plastic barricades were erected to cover up signs posted on the student union's message board calling for justice for the victims. The university suspended the union soon after. In addition, at least two people who gave interviews to foreign media about the fire later indicated on social media that the government had pressured them to stop. Last weekend, the authorities summoned international media organizations to an in-person meeting with national security officials, who issued an apparent threat about spreading false information and smear campaigns, according to a statement from the Office for Safeguarding National Security. "Don't say that you weren't warned," an official who declined to give his name told the assembled journalists. Beijing's recent repression echoes its response to past tragedies. In 1989, the public came out to mourn the death of a reformist leader, Hu Yaobang. These gatherings evolved into the Tiananmen Square protest, which China brutally crushed. For Beijing, the episode offered a lesson. Mourning can lead to resistance. Its fear of history repeating may explain the absurd accusation from a Hong Kong spokesperson that recent gatherings of mourners at memorial sites were really the work of foreign forces seeking to maliciously smear the government's relief efforts. Beijing's National Security Office in Hong Kong claimed that bad actors were using the tragedy to revive protest memories of the city's 2019 pro-democracy demonstrations and possibly launch another color revolution. On Sunday, as some Hong Kongers were still mourning, the city held a patriots-only legislative election. Only 32% of the city voted, in part because the regime had pre-vetted the candidates, purging older lawmakers from the ballots who had connections to the system that predated Beijing's clampdown of the city in 2020. A new guard of uber nationalists took their place. Both the election and the response to the fire suggest that Hong Kong is moving ever closer to Beijing's system of repression, which meets crises not with transparency and reform, but with threats and censorship. A more authoritarian order almost certainly won't tackle the deep-seated problems. Corporate misconduct, regulatory neglect, and an unaccountable elite that seem to have contributed to last month's tragedy and that raise the risk of future ones. Hong Kong's leaders might decide to get rid of bamboo scaffolding, but don't expect that to fix anything. Our third story, The View from Inside the AI Bubble, written by Alex Reisner. In a small room in San Diego, a man in a black leather jacket explained to me how to save the world from destruction by AI. Max Tegmark, a notable figure in the AI safety movement, believes that artificial general intelligence, or AGI, could precipitate the end of human life. I was in town for the NUR IPS, one of the largest AI research conferences, and Tegmark had invited me, along with five other journalists, to a briefing on an AI safety index that he would release the next day. No company scored better than a C+. The threat of technological superintelligence is the stuff of science fiction, yet it has become a topic of serious discussion in the past few years. Granted, generative AI is a powerful technology that has already had a massive impact on our work and culture, but superintelligence has become one of several questionable narratives promoted by the AI industry, along with ideas that AI learns like a human, that it has emergent capabilities, that reasoning models are actually reasoning, and that the technology will eventually improve itself. I traveled to NUR IPS, held at a waterfront fortress, the waterfront fortress that is the San Diego Convention Center, partly to understand how seriously these narratives are taken within the AI industry. I do feel we're on a quest, and a quest should be for the Holy Grail, Rich Sutton, the legendary computer scientist, proclaimed in a talk about superintelligence. This year's conference sponsors had booths to promote their accomplishments and impress attendees with their R&D visions. There were companies you've heard of, such as Google, Meta, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, ByteDance, and Tesla, and ones you probably haven't, such as RunPod, Poolside, and Olama. The conference is a primary battleground in AI's talent war. Much of the recruiting effort happens outside the conference center itself, at semi-secret invitation-only events in downtown San Diego. These events captured the ever-growing opulence of the industry. Of 5,630 papers presented in the poster sessions at Neuer IPS, only two mention artificial general intelligence in their title. An informal survey of 115 researchers at the conference suggested that more than a quarter didn't even know what AGI stands for. At the same time of AGI, its accompanying prestige seemed at least partly responsible for the buffet. The amenities I encountered certainly weren't paid for by chatbot profits. OpenAI, for instance, reportedly expects its massive losses to continue until 2030. In one of the keynote speeches, the sociologist and writer Zeynep Tufekci warned researchers that the idea of superintelligence was preventing them from understanding the technology they were building. The talk, titled "Are We Having the Wrong Nightmares About AI?", mentioned several dangers posed by AI chatbots, including widespread addiction to chatbots and the understanding of methods for establishing truth. After Tufekci gave her talk, the first audience member to ask a question appeared annoyed. "Have you been following recent research?" the man asked. "Because that's the exact problems we're trying to fix, so we know of these concerns." Tufekci responded, "I don't really see these discussions. I keep seeing people discuss mass unemployment versus human extinction." It struck me that both might be correct, that many AI developers are thinking about the technology's most tangible problems, while public conversations about AI, including those among the most prominent developers themselves, are dominated by imagined ones. Even the conference's name contained a contradiction. The name Neuer IPS is short for Neural Information Processing Systems, but artificial neural networks were conceived in the 1940s by a logician and neuropsychologist duo who wildly underestimated the complexity of biological neurons and overstated their similarity to a digital computer. Regardless, the central feature in AI's culture is an obsession with the idea that a computer is a mind. I attended an interview with Yoshua Bengio, one of three godfathers of AI. Bengio, a co-inventor of an algorithm that makes ChatGPT possible, recently started a nonprofit called Law Zero to encourage the development of AI that is, quote, safe by design, end quote. He took the nonprofit's name from a law featured in several Isaac Asimov stories that states that a robot should not allow humans to be harmed. Bengio was concerned that, in a possible dystopian future, AI might deceive their creators and that those who will have very powerful AIs could misuse it for political advantage in terms of influencing public opinion. I looked around to see if anyone else was troubled by the disconnect. Bengio did not mention how fake videos are already affecting public discourse. Neither did he meaningfully address the burgeoning chatbot mental health crisis or the pillaging of the arts and humanities. Bengio has written elsewhere about the more immediate dangers of AI, but the technical and speculative focus of his remarks captures the sentiment among technologists who now dominate the public conversation about our future. Ostensibly, they are trying to save us, but who actually benefits from their predictions? As I spoke with 25-year-olds entertaining seven-figure job offers and watched the industry's multi-millionaire luminaries debate the dangers of superintelligence, the answer seemed clear. Next, America is Failing Its Children, written by Xochitl Gonzalez. Nothing encapsulates the failures of our society more than what just happened to Mia Tretta. When she was 15, she was shot in the stomach by a classmate at her high school in California. Yesterday, she survived a second school shooting of her short life. A person opened fire at Brown University, where Tretta is a junior. Students were studying for finals when a shooter walked into an economics classroom and started firing, killing 2 students, injuring 9, and inflicting terror on not just a campus, but an entire city. No suspect has been named yet. When I left Brooklyn to attend Brown in 1995, when New York City had yet to shake its rough-and-tumble reputation, of all the amenities that the Ivy League campus provided, bountiful libraries, a full-service gym, the most luxurious to me was a sense of safety. I'd walk around campus at all hours of the night. Just the other day, my freshman roommate and I reminisced about keeping our dorm room unlocked so our friends could come and go. Despite how much has changed in the decades since I was there, it was this sense of security that had, after what she'd endured in high school, appealed to Tretta. I'm a trustee at Brown now. Many of my friends have children there, and I know and care for countless staff members and administrators. When yet another tragedy like this takes place in America, everyone grieves, but it feels different when it happens so close to home. When you hear that your friend's daughter is hiding in a bathroom in the sciences library, you can picture the tiny floor tile she's staring at. You can conjure the smell of the heat in the dorm, where a student you recently had coffee with is sheltering in place, and you're able to picture the streets where the shooter is rumored to have been running at large. I was a senior at Brown, sitting in a coffee shop a stone's throw from where yesterday's attack occurred, when I read about 2 boys in Colorado who donned black trench coats, walked into their high school, and opened fire with pump-action shotguns. At the same time, it was a shocking story. It inspired a documentary, a film, and songs. If each school shooting that happened since had inspired such creative input, we would populate an entire streaming service. For many of America's children, it's the culmination of the zero-sum game of elite college admissions. They have been trained from their earliest years to pass exams and write essays so that they may one day be lucky enough to study for finals in an Ivy League classroom where, randomly, at any moment, a shooter might open fire. No matter how great our collective amnesia, these mass shootings add up. Tretta is not even the only student at Brown who had already been involved in one. Zoe Weissman, now 20, was only 12 when gunshots were fired at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. She was in a classroom in the middle school across campus. Yesterday, she told the New York Times, "What I've been feeling most is just, how dare this country allow this to happen to someone like me twice?" We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.